Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Finish up projects with GE-branded silicone sealants. Tub and tile silicone is 100% waterproof and offers same-day water readiness, making it perfect to use in kitchens and bathrooms. Shop our selection of GE sealants in-store and on Menards.com and save big. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to view all of our other great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Save big money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, including pouring a walkway, setting a post, or even installing stone veneer. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Yeah, there it is. When that robot voice comes in, you know it is time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to
ELC.
Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks and sneaks using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or hey, maybe you're just at the grocery store looking for some eggs. Maybe you're just wandering around the wasteland that is our existence these days. Well, fear not. We're going to be in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be. And that is completely free thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. Those fine folks bring this show to you. Their support, their generosity means we get to keep making these. Boy, are we grateful. In exchange, they get some cool perks, including ad-free versions of the show, video versions of the show on demand, and a whole bevy of bonus content, including extra episodes, extra things to listen to. You got Feeling This, the show about the feelings behind video games with Christian Spicer and Alex Solman. You've got developer chats. You've got the Wednesday paid DLC program, where Lana Bashinsky joins us to talk about the stuff the patrons want to talk about. Lana not here last week. We had a wacky time, just Christian and myself. It was fun, and it always is, and it's always just for patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, it's the show all about games in their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, that's spelled with two N's and one T, and I am joined, as always, by my friend, slash co-host, slash nemesis, the guy who's also hoping to three-peat, not messing up, which he's never done, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Days since last mess up. Somehow negative. I don't know. I don't know how that's the case. Jeff, can I tell you something?
No. I mean, yes. Okay. Go tell me something.
How about if you email us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com, subject line, Little Cupid. Little Cupid. We have yet another Secret Santa. We're so far removed from Christmas at this point that it feels, but yet another Secret Santa.
Secret Valentine.
A Secret Valentine offering up, they choose you.
That's right.
To offering up 10 subs to the Patreon.
Holy moly.
So let me tell you this. The people that are patrons love it, and they want other people to check it out too. I mean, this is true grassroots community support. I love to see it. It blows me away when folks reach out wanting to do this. Little Cupid subject line. We will draw 10 at random. dlcfeedback@gmail.com. This is for new subscribers only.
These are gift subs gifted by a Secret Valentine, who was also previously a Secret Santa and I think a secret New Year's baby. This secret person is amazing, and we're so grateful. Continuing to spread the love.
L. Simpson, that's too obvious. No. Lisa S.
We are so grateful, and thank you. And again, 10 gift subs. So send those into dlcfeedback@gmail.com with the subject line, little Cupid. Oh, we have an awesome show for you, ladies and gentlemen. We got some cool stuff to talk about. We're going to get into some tabletop time. And that is because we have a phenomenal guest joining us. You know, the DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, woohoo, I'm excited because DLC stands for Dreaming Like a Citizen. Because we have the developer behind Citizen Sleeper and the just released Citizen Sleeper 2 Starward Vector, GDCA and IndieCade Award winner, named one of the most exciting indie talents around by Eurogamer, Gareth Damian Martin, joining us for the first time. Hey, Gareth, welcome to the show.
Hi, wow, hello. Love the intro. Very, very nice.
Congratulations on the release of Citizen Sleeper 2. We talked a little bit about it last week, but this must be a pretty awesome time for you right now with the game having just hit and getting critical acclaim.
Yeah, it's a pretty crazy time. I mean, it's literally almost 1 week to the hour from the release date of Citizen Sleeper 2. So I'm still in the processing zone. I think I'm still like, I've got a little like forehead wheel that's going round. I'm kind of loading thoughts slowly on everything. But yeah, I mean, the response has been crazy. I think we've ended up in this week with more copies sold than we sold in the first month of Citizen Sleeper 1.
Wow, that's great.
Critically, it's been huge. We've just been pipped by Kingdom Come to be the top-rated game of the year so far. But otherwise, I think we're doing pretty good. So yeah, seeing as we are just a team that is me and a couple of other guys far away, it's something I'm really happy about. So
it's an extraordinary accomplishment. And I think the game is incredible. We were talking about it a little bit last week. And we'll talk about it more. I want to talk about it in the playlist section as well, because I've been playing more of it and want to pick your brain a little bit about the game in detail. But what is the process of knowing that something is done and ready to be released as a solo developer? Because I feel like that's got to be different than you are part of some big
corporate
machine.
Tells you when it's due.
Yeah, it's like, we need it out this quarter. You get to decide when it's done, or maybe not. I don't know. What is that process like?
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite kind of structured in the way that I approach things. So I actually kind of pick my done date quite far out. And I kind of try to then, I try to work it out based on what the objectives I have for the game is. And then I try to get a really accurate window, like a month or whatever, where I'm like, okay, I want the game to be done by then. And then I build a schedule, because that kind of keeps me on track. I think the most dangerous thing as a solo developer is actually there's no boss. There's no one to keep you on track. So yeah, you kind of have to do that yourself. So I have to do a lot of scheduling and a lot of control of my time. But in terms of feeling like it's done, that's a really nebulous thing, I think, in games. I always say, when you get towards the end of development, you're in the worst possible position as a developer to judge whether or not the game is done, because you're so bored of it. You've seen it all, all the surprises, it's really hard for it to be alive for you. So it is really tricky, but sometimes you just get these little flashes, these little moments where you're playing the game and you're like, oh, I can feel a 10% of something that I know players will feel like 80, 90% of, right? And then you're like, okay, what can we do to kind of move towards that? And I think for me, it's always that, my games, I really want to deliver a specific kind of emotional experience for the player. And so it's when I start to feel those little twinkles firing. I don't know, sometimes when I play it, when I start to feel those moments, the music comes in, I'm in a desperate position. This is happening with these characters and I'm feeling stressed and emotional and caught up in the story. I'm like, okay, if this can happen to me, I wrote it, then it can definitely happen to the players.
That's fantastic. So, and then that moment, you put the game out, it's happening. It's, you've completed it. You take a breath. What's the next feeling? Is it, now I got to think about what I'm doing next, or do you allow yourself a grace period of recuperation, or what is your process there?
Do you get all your die back, and do they all have 100%?
Are they all broken? Like mine are.
They are glitched like crazy. The emotional experience is really up down, like earthquake, tracking. It's because the moment the game comes out, you see reviews and then you see bad negative things, and you take those negative things really strongly. And so immediately you're like, oh, I failed. It's totally wrong. And then you read a bit more and you're like, oh, but they love this bit. And then you're like, okay, maybe that means it's good. And then you read the next review and you're like, oh, it's bad. It's good. It's bad. And then you're trying to work it out. And then every time you see something bad, you're like, ah. And every time you see something good, you're like, yes. And so you you slowly like this. And then eventually, like as it starts to even out and as you start to feel less raw and vulnerable about it, I think you kind of like settle into a place where you're like. And so by the end of the first week, I'm kind of like, okay, I'm pretty good. But at the same time, in terms of future ideas, you know, I find that when I'm working on a game for a couple of years, a few years, and Citizen Sleeper now, the first one, the second one, it's been 5 years, right? I'm like making ideas for fun, like other ideas for fun, right? Like I'm my brain is like it's like a fox caught in a trap or something. It's like it's chewing off its own leg to try and get out, right? So it's I can't think about Citizen Sleeper. So for a day off, you know, I'll think about another idea and I'll write some notes. And so actually I've got a whole stack of things that I want to do. And usually That's one cool. of them has kind of risen to the top. So yeah, I have a pretty clear idea of the next one. But this time around, I think, you know, after so long on one series, after doing two games, doing 5 years, it'll be really nice to like go into the quiet bit and not announce it for a while, right? Mm. To work on it.
Yeah.
Because Citizen Sleeper 2 was almost completely made in public. Like people played the first game, then it was the DLC, and then we announced the sequel almost 2 years out. You know, so it was that can be quite tiring. So yeah, I'm looking forward to just being able to go away and just kind of like squirrel away into a corner and like make something really cool and just secretly know that like nobody else knows this thing exists until I want them to. So that will be nice.
Right. How about at the end of this episode you announce what's next? How does that
okay, yeah, yeah. Just give me a second. I'm just gonna go into the corner and
a tight 60 to 70 minutes here and then, you know.
you may not want to discuss it any further than we have already, but I'm curious if whatever your next thing or your next things are, do you imagine them being of the same kind? Because I feel like you kind of have a little genre here, right? This sort of literary, you know, tabletop-esque thing that you've crafted out that I think is really cool and special and not exactly like anything else. Is it, do you feel like you have a genre now, or do you want to do something completely different?
Yeah, I think I have a genre in the sense that the genre is like the Gareth Damian Martin genre. But I think other than that, I'm really eager to do, you know, I often talk about having like a GM or DM mindset. And as a GM or DM, I love to like play tricks and surprises. Like that's I'm a trickster. And I think that's the same when I'm making stuff. I like the idea of like picking up on some ideas, but then I love doing experiments. I love kind of messing with things. And I really would be disappointed if the next thing I put out, people are like, oh, that's exactly what I expected. So I definitely will be building on what I've already done. I'm, you know, I agree. I like my games too. I like, you know, I like writing. I like writing in games. I like finding ways to get good writing into games and getting people who maybe don't usually read tons in their lives, like reading within a video game. That's yeah. been really satisfying and exciting for me. So I will keep doing that, but I want to find lots of new ways of doing it to keep me fresh and excited for making it really.
I love you saying that. And I, you know, that's been one of my big projects. We have a book club here that's associated with the video game show, trying to get people to read more. And I love the fact that Citizen Sleeper doesn't shy away from being literary, being, you know, that the prose, there's a lot of care and attention to it, and that it's not shying away from being something that is, you know, that asks something of the reader, you know, is not dumbed down in any sense. And so kudos to that. And
thank you.
I can't wait to see what, you know, that you continue that. And I hope other people are inspired by it and it becomes, you know, more prominent in not just in the indie scene, but across video games.
Yeah, no, me too. I mean, I think prose is the cheapest, most powerful technology, right? Like it is incredibly powerful for people. And I think it's often people don't realize how much of an effect it can have on them until they encounter it in a good way and in a way that connects to them. And I think games are an incredible way to deliver it. So yeah, I hope to see it too, definitely.
I also love the idea of there being a genre called sleeper likes. Oh, so we got another sleeper like. Oh, no one makes them like the original, but I'm excited to play another sleeper like. It's fun.
Yeah, it would be fun, definitely.
Awesome. Well, let's get into the main show and start the way we always do with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that have happened in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. You can also send comments, questions, anything you'd like. We love hearing from you at that email address, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. You can also hang out in our Discord, which has got a lot of cool folks hanging out, talking about games and all sorts of other stuff, books. The Discord is 5x5DLC on Discord. Check it out. You'll probably have a great time. But Gareth, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Yeah, I had one that kind of snuck in under the line. Like, I think it was only maybe today that I suddenly spotted on Rock, Paper, Shotgun that Duskers, which is a game I absolutely love, completely underrated, undervalued game, is getting a spiritual successor called Humanity 2.0.
Yes, this was part of an update that Misfits Attic has put out. This is the developer behind the original Duskers. And a number of projects were outlined. By the way, I love this. This is an indie developer that is saying, hey, these are some prototypes. Check out these prototypes that we're working on and get excited and tell us what you think, which one we should be most putting our energy into. I'm curious, Gareth, what you think about that approach. But also, Duskers is not a game that I played. Christian, I don't know if you have, but this is a game from 2016. So it's been a minute since Duskers was released. But it looks like something very, very cool. It's not something that I have been aware of. Can you tell us a little bit about what drew you to Duskers, why you enjoyed that game, and why you're excited about its spiritual successor, Humanity 2.0?
Yeah, I mean, we're going back a bit, true. And you made me feel very old just when you said 2016, because I suddenly remembered that, like, yeah, I was writing for Killscreen back when I first encountered Duskers. I actually interviewed Tim Keenan at the time, who was making the game. And it's this really cool space game where you play like a drone operator in deep space after some kind of terrible catastrophe has basically destroyed every spaceship in existence. And you're kind of picking your way through this junkyard of star systems. They're all filled with destroyed ships. And you're like trapped. You're kind of like in your just little cabin inside this spaceship you're in. But you have a team of drones that you can command with command line. So you actually type like... you know, drone one, D1, open like door 3. And then Wow. You watch on this little map as like the drone goes and opens the door. And it's kind of like a combo of that bit from Aliens where they're like checking the motion tracker. Mm. Or like the bit when they first all go out into the hive and there's one guy sat back like in the van with all the TV screens, like watching them blink out, right? So it's like playing as that guy. And I think what's really cool about it is the way that it, I remember talking to Tim at the time about this, the way that the game kind of includes your like office and you being sat at a keyboard and typing as part of the game, like the speed at which you can type at or accidentally making a typo when an alien, like you get a drone to open a door and something like takes it out and you're like, oh, we've got to close that door again quick. And you're trying to type as fast as you can and hit enter and then you miss hit it and you hit delete and you're like, no, my drones are dying. Like, it's just a really cool game and was a big influence on my first game, In Other Waters, which is like a UI-based game with a kind of similar element where you're the more sciencey, where you're the AI inside the suit of a biologist and you're kind of seeing everything from like sonar and scans and stuff like this. So it's just a genre I really love and it's such a like understated game, but just really, really cool to play, really spooky and interesting, full of like loads of interesting upgrades to add to the drones and stuff. So the idea that even after like basically 10 years, we might be getting a sequel just seemed like one of those kind of miracle announcements where you're like, wow, okay, I never thought this would happen.
Yeah, and it looks like they're attempting to really add some new stuff to the formula here where, at least according to the video, the idea is that you'll also now be able to take stuff from these derelict spacecrafts and add them to your own and have some sort of building element with the vessel. So the drones are actually plucking components and placing them on your ship. Looks like they're really trying to push it forward, not just, remake Duskers.
No, 100%. And actually, one of the most fun things in the first game was that if you found a spaceship and you were like, as you were exploring it, you were like, oh, this spaceship seems in pretty good shape, actually. Let me like check out all the parts of it. You could actually like say, oh, I'm going to take this spaceship now. I'm going to like jet over. Now this will be my spaceship with all of the upgrades that it has. And I'm going to leave my spaceship as junk. And there's like, there's lots of really cool little things to it. They also had a couple of cool other games in there as well. They had like a, what they called like a Littlefinger simulator
from Game of Thrones.
It's such a cool idea. Like you play as a kind of, like scheming lowborn, like backstabbing and kind of like trying to create fights between the aristocracy, which is also a really cool idea.
Yeah, this notion that there's no direct war gaming or battling. It's literally just goading the highborns into fighting each other on your behalf. Pretty cool. They called it Crusader Kings Light, where you never have any armies yourself. It's a really neat idea. And then the third one, you can summarize that one too. It's kind of a chess thing.
Right. It's like a chess roguelike. They call it Magic Wizard Chess. It looked kind of like very interesting. I wasn't super clear exactly how it plays out, but there's some kind of like psychological evaluation thing going on as you're playing the chess. So it's super intriguing. Three really interesting proposals. In fact, I'd just love them to make all three. So I'm really hoping that people pick up on this. I know that Misfits Attic has been quite quiet for a long time. So it'd be really cool to see people get behind this and see if some of these games can get made.
You had spoken earlier about Citizen Sleeper 2 being something that you were developing in public, essentially. That seems like, coming out Misfit Attic. I don't know. I can't say that. Misfit Attic coming out and sort of showing these at the prototype phase. Do you think that that's a wise decision? Do you think that's something that puts more pressure on them? What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think in this case, it's a pretty cool decision. I think the thing with indie games, especially on the really low end, is if you have like a vision for something you want to do in terms of like marketing or how you want to put your games out in the world, I think you can get a lot of mileage out of just going for it and just trying to actually do something a little different. I think it's really easy to fall into the pattern of like the same set of kind of marketing beats. I think it's if you can find something unique in your games and kind of put that forward, then that can be really helpful. And definitely trying to get, if they want to get like beta testers in or people trying these games out, that's also a really good way to just build up like a small core audience who are going to be your cheerleaders as you go into development. So I think it's a good idea. Who knows whether it works? It's so hard to get any kind of traction right now. So few game journalist like outfits left, and those are oversubscribed, and like there's too many news stories. So good luck to them. I don't think I don't see anything wrong with it. I think it could work.
Christian, I love this ability to see the prototype stage of something. I just think it's such a cool kind of look behind the curtain. What do you make of the video that we get to see?
Yeah, I really try to have my cake and eat it too. I realize the hypocrisy of what I'm about to say. I love stuff like this. I love learning about game development. I love when we get, Jeff Keighley did this was after the fact, but like the last hours of documentaries that Keighley and folks made, I thought were fascinating. I love seeing this stuff happen in real time. But the hypocrisy in me is that I also love Fallout 4's announcement. I also love not knowing about something and then something saying the spiritual successor to Duskers is out now. Like that, I also think is a real treat. So I do feel like it's just a total hypocrite of being like, I like them both. I mean, I think what makes this version appealing is that hopefully there is work being done and you actually get to see it versus we are making AAA blockbuster based on established IP. We are announcing it today. Get hype, and then that goes dark for 7 years, and then that's been canceled. Right. I think that's the kind that rubs me the wrong way. So I hope we continue to see you know, via the peeled back curtain, what's going on, or as Gareth mentioned, with, you know, the beta testers that they might be bringing in for these games and stuff like that. That's exciting. And hopefully it goes well, because as Gareth knows better than you or I, Jeff, game development's hard.
Yeah, well, you know, I think we've seen over the last several years, early access being a real feasible path to publishing with indie games in particular, and allowing communities to build around games before they're finished, essentially. And I think this might be even the next level of that, right? Stepping even farther back and saying, this is a prototype. This is, you know, this isn't even early access. This is just a concept that we have. And, you know, are you excited about this? Are you excited? Which of these three are you most excited about? I think that's really cool. And I do think it brings community to indie developers in the way that Gareth is talking about being difficult, getting separating the you know, separating from the noise and getting some attention for smaller developers that might not, you know, be the centerpiece of a big public, you know, PR push. So I hope this works. And I think it's really, really cool to see these really interesting ideas. I'm particularly excited personally about that Magic Wizard chess game. It just looks so neat. I mean, I love roguelikes and I love chess. And this, you know, as Gareth pointed out, this, like, it's almost got a inscription style, like meta thing of you're being also evaluated, you know, your psychosis is being evaluated, which I don't know what to make of that, but it looks neat. So I'm rooting for these games.
We need Nintendo's fingerprint sensor to come out for it, you know. So.
That's right. Check my pulse. All right, Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week?
Speaking of long dormant things kind of coming back, look, I won't say who said this, but some idiot we had on this show said that E3 was going to be great one year when E3 was canceled. I don't want to look, everybody we have on this show, I respect their time, so I don't want to say who said that. Uh-huh. Which co-host / nemesis maybe said that. But E3 was shuttered. But is this a spiritual successor? Econ?
No, the answer is no.
I know it's Icon. Icon with two I's. Econ. I really want to call it Econ just because it's stupid. ESA. The ESA is back with a new conference that does feel very different than E3. And I'll talk through how it's kind of described. I think the way it's described sounds a little self-serious. I am hopeful that something good could come from this. So it is called the Interactive Innovation Conference, IICON, and it's being held in Las Vegas, and it's being pitched as, quote, an essential convening for change makers across industries.
Oh, change makers.
Thought makers thinking about stuff that's revolutionary. It's
so you can come. You can come with any denomination of bill, and they will make change.
Quarters, yeah. Let me in. I got the quarter. But people that have already confirmed are organizations: Amazon Games, Disney, Electronic Arts, Epic Games, Microsoft, Nintendo of America, Sony Interactive Entertainment, Square Enix, Take-Two Interactive, Ubisoft, and Warner Brothers Games, which maybe we'll talk about later. What's left of Warner Brothers Games? Those are big hitters. Those are AAA publishers, and coming together in some form or factor to talk, share ideas, further the industry. They say that there will be some audience member thing later. Icon or the ESA has mentioned there will be some broader invite-only thing. I don't know if this is just think tanking on a stage, like public podcasting with heads of these corporations. I'm not sure what it's going to be yet, but, you know, literal hats off to the ESA for getting these businesses that compete against each other to come together, hopefully in a way that can make the industry better. That's my glass half full hope for what the ESA is doing here. I mean, I think it has potential to be exciting.
What is the attendance of those companies mean? What does that mean? I think
the teacher says, Epic Games? Someone says,
here. That's my question is, what is this and why? And because it doesn't seem like it is these companies coming and showing off products or making announcements, or it does feel more like a real conference where we are sort of interacting on some level to exchange ideas and inspiration. And maybe there's a representative from one of those companies or several representatives. I don't know what this is. And I have a hard time parsing the announcement to discern what it is.
But you're still getting the logo tattoo with me, right?
Definitely am getting the logo tattoo. Oh, sick. Two eyes? Come on. No, I don't know what this is. And I don't know if it's a big deal or not, or if it's really just a sort of inside baseball corporate thing, or if it's going to actually matter for developers and gamers. I don't know, Gareth, do you have any sense of... Are you excited for Icon?
It's above my pay grade, I think. I don't jump over the age is not invited currently.
Change. Come on.
Yeah, I make change definitely from a 50, sure. It's hard to know, right? Like you say, we have no idea what this thing is, and it feels like a conference, feels like a business conference that's going to sit here. E3 start kind of feels like winding back to what E3 was before it became like a consumer show, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of funny because it's not like E3 will grow to be E3 again, because Summer Games Fest has like fully inhabited the corpse of E3 and is dancing around in it. So there's no like space for ESA to like take that back. So maybe they're just kind of backfilling in the space that's left behind from not having a conference there. Feels like a kind of, maybe it's a place to make deals. I don't know. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. But it seemed, and maybe, you know, beyond GDC, which is feels more like a place for indies to make deals or smaller publishers, maybe it's for bigger publishers to make those bigger deals. But yeah, I have to admit, I am slightly willfully ignorant of the larger movings of the games industry sometimes in my little corner. So we will see what these monsters bring when they all gather together.
These monsters, I like that. It does seem like a step back because they had three E's and now they only have two I's. So that's clear step backward.
And it's a bit late to take inspiration from the Nintendo Wii when you're naming a conference, right?
It's true.
It's the E-con.
Maybe it is E-con. Yeah, maybe it is E-con. Yeah.
Nintendo E-con.
That makes it sound even less exciting. An E-con conference? Oh, I passed that class barely. Gareth, again, maybe you're not willing to talk about this, but I'm curious. As somebody who put out, you know, Citizen Sleeper 1, I think by even your own admission, was landed with a bigger impact than you even expected and got a lot of deserved acclaim. So I think the fact that you were working on a sequel perhaps put you into the crosshairs of some of these. Like, does Jeff Keighley, like, reach out to you and go, hey, can I show your game? Or does a PAX reach out? Were you kind of involved in any of that courtship process?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be if you're an indie dev, right? But my publisher, Fellow Traveler, deal with a lot of that. They do the courtship for me. That's one of the jobs that they do. They do the dance and the kissing of the hands and the exchanging of handkerchiefs or whatever it is that happens.
Right.
But I think... yeah, I mean, you have to be part of it and you have to be thinking about it. I mean, we have a Game Pass deal on both Citizen Sleeper games. So, you know, we deal with Microsoft, we deal with Sony, we're on PlayStation 5, Citizen Sleeper 1's on PlayStation Plus. But it's kind of like, you know, they've got all these companies have a lot of things going on, as we know. They aren't necessarily super focused on me. So it's about me using my publisher to get a bigger voice in the room, you know, someone who's got multiple games and so therefore can kind of like make bigger offers to Game Pass or to Sony or so. Yeah, it's, you know, it's something that I have to do, but it can be a little frustrating sometimes when, you know, it feels like you're not really being listened to. But I'm very aware that I'm just not necessarily part of that world. And I don't mind that too much. You know, I enjoy being a solo developer and I enjoy kind of like working away on my own things. And, yeah, try not to get too scared that if Game Pass suddenly disappears, you know, I guess, all indie developers kind of know, like, they just have to go on to the next thing, right? That's the industry moves quickly and things happen fast. So they're less like, it's less like partners to some extent and more like just these huge giants which are moving around you, right? And you just have to try not to get stepped on. And if they can give you a little bit of a lift, then that's great.
Yeah. So from your perspective, Game Pass is a positive.
Oh, yeah. I love Game Pass. Yeah. I mean, yeah. They've been amazing for Citizen Sleeper, right? We had like 1 million people play Citizen Sleeper 1. About between 600 and 700,000 of those were Game Pass players. And I think the Game Pass led to the game's success on other platforms. I don't think it cannibalizes sales of indie games at all. It might be different for AAA. I don't really have experience of that. But from my perspective, Game Pass gives you huge visibility. And the coolest thing about Game Pass is that, you know, a huge majority of the Citizen Sleeper reviews on Game Pass are people saying exactly the same thing, which is, I don't usually like these kind of games, but I absolutely love this game. And I just, that was so nice for me. And I think Game Pass was felt like such a good opportunity to do what we were talking about earlier, is kind of like propose a way of using writing in games and a way of storytelling, and actually getting that out to just a mass audience and having them react kind of shows you that there is an audience for all kinds of things. And in this space where sometimes I think bigger companies struggle to imagine things that audience might like, I think actually there's a huge opportunity for indie devs to imagine something new and try to get it to that huge audience. So yeah, I personally love Game Pass.
That's great. Yeah, I love hearing that. And you're right. It's a bunch of people who probably wouldn't have bought it, but will give it a shot because it's on Game Pass, and then find out that they love it. That's cool. All right, we have more stories of the week coming in just a second, but we're going to take a quick break for a sponsor. We'll be right back right after this. This episode of DLC is brought to you by Factor. Oh, Christian, I am a lazy person. I'm a lazy person. I will skip lunch rather than deal with lunch because I'm so lazy.
Oh, I'll step that up a notch. I'm so lazy, but also persnickety. I'm lazy, but I want to eat well. I'm not going to just put anything into my gullet. It needs to be good quality food, but also
fast, easy. I don't have to think about it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I want a unicorn, basically.
Give me all those checklists. Give me that checklist. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have that checklist for you. Enter Factor. If you are ready to optimize your nutrition this year, Factor has chef-made gourmet meals that make eating well easy. These are dietitian approved and ready to heat and eat in just 2 minutes. So you can fuel right and feel great no matter what you're doing during the day. I literally just did that yesterday. My kids wanted to have mac and cheese for dinner. And I was like, okay, you know what? You can have mac and cheese. I'm going to have a Factor meal. You know what I had? I had roasted garlic chicken with pan gravy, chive sour cream mashed potatoes, and garlic green beans. That's what I had. You know what I did it for? 2 minutes. 2 minutes! And it was ready to go. My kids ate the mac and cheese and peas. I ate a gourmet chef-prepared meal that I had without having to stress about it, because I was a solo dad. My wife's out of town. I had to fend for myself, which I barely can do.
Oh, my wife was in town, and we literally did the same thing yesterday, where my kids were like, can we just have eggs and biscuits? And I was like, fine, you monsters. And my wife and I, we both had Chipotle spiced potato and pepper bowls.
Woo.
Fantastic. There's a cream that you pour on top and you mix and you do.
2 minutes. It's ready. Delicious. In 2 minutes. Factor arrives fresh and fully prepared, perfect for any active, busy lifestyle. And hey, this is nutrition that you can count on. You can lose up to 8 pounds in 8 weeks with the Factor Keto meals. That's based on a randomized controlled clinical trial with Factor Keto. And results, of course, will vary depending on diet and exercise. But hey, maybe a good option for you. And they have 40 options across 8 dietary preferences on the menu every single week. It's easy to pick meals tailored to your goals. You can choose from preferences like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, or Keto. And Factor can help you feel your best all day long with wholesome smoothies as well. Breakfasts, grab-and-go snacks, and more add-ons. Reach your goals this year with ingredients you can trust and convenience that can't be beat. Eat smart with Factor. Get started at factormeals.com/DLC50off. That's code DLC50OFF to get 50% off your first box, plus free shipping. That's code DLC50off at factormeals.com/DLC50off to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. All right, my story of the week is going to be what kind of Christian was alluding to earlier, which is this report about the woeful state of Warner Brothers game publishing. Warner Brothers, who has a number of excellent studios under its umbrella, evidently is kind of reeling, still reeling, of course, from Suicide Squad, Kill the Justice League's tumultuous release and Ultimate Shuttering. And just recently, Multiverses, which ironically, my son has decided he now just wants to get into. Very excited about Multiverses, even though it is dying. But Warner Brothers is, if you believe this report, in a state of flux. It sounds like the next thing from Rocksteady is going to be a return to form. They're like, yeah, we need that money. We need the thing we can bet on. Give us a Batman. So Rocksteady evidently is returning to
a
single
VR franchise.
Yeah. is returning to a single player Batman game next, but that is multiple years out as they are sort of just spinning up now. The other part of this report is that Wonder Woman, the game that was announced at the Game Awards in 2021 to much fanfare, has not been going well and has been rebooted. We had heard that Wonder Woman was going to use the Shadow of Mordor style Nemesis system. Evidently, that is no longer the case. That has been abandoned. And they've spent over $100 million on it, and it's still years away from release if it ever makes it to market, which is a really sad commentary for a game I think, Christian, both of us were really excited for. And then also WB Montreal was thinking about doing a Gotham Knights successor or a game starring John Constantine, which is pretty cool. Or a game about the Flash, all of which have been nixed for various reasons. And now they're pitching a Game of Thrones game. So it doesn't sound like anything is happening anytime soon at Warner Brothers, even though there's a lot of talent there still. And, you know, Gareth, obviously you haven't, as we've covered extensively already, you know, your experience is so much different as a solo developer, but I don't know if you have any affection for any of the WB games or any kind of insight into what it must be like in that kind of chaos.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that there are like WB games that I'm especially like familiar with and that I love. I mean, I remember Arkham Asylum back in the day, Rocksteady and you know, the great dev and a British dev as well. And I think the thing that really struck me, you know, kind of looking through this was the phrase like struggled to coalesce. Mm. And I think this is the thing that kind of scares me about AAA is just this feeling of, I can't imagine what it's like to be inside a production when you know that production is like not coming together and you know you're putting years of your life into something, which, you know, I think when those situations go bad, like the developers know before anybody else, right, that, okay, this thing's not, it's not coming together. I don't know what's happening within studios that these things aren't like struggling to coalesce. But to me, even if I was talking about my own game, even as a solo developer, and that's the way I was kind of thinking and talking about it, I'd be really worried about that because, you know, like I was saying earlier, I have a, you know, really tight schedule, and I kind of like try to keep things very structured, and I don't wait for things to kind of coalesce, right? Like I have a plan, make a plan, and I try to execute the plan. And yeah, sometimes I read this stuff and I'm like, what's happening in there? Like, where's the plan? And I, you know, I don't think it's necessarily, I don't know whose fault it is or what's happening, but it feels like there's so often I read these stories and I think about AAA studios, and obviously it's way harder to manage hundreds of people than it is just to manage silly old me. But yeah, it's kind of scary even just to think about making games in that way, where you're just kind of like throwing money into a big hole and hoping that it like coalesces into something. And it's like, oh, okay, that's a form of gambling that's a little too expensive for my tastes.
It does feel like a management problem across the board. Is that it just managing these large teams just feels to be... You see failure at every turn, it seems.
Well, they only have so many die to start the day, Jeff.
And yeah,
so
I guess that's
what when they leave their house to start work at a studio, you have 50% failure rate immediately on your first roll. So how? What about the stress of that?
Gareth, have you? I love the idea of structure because I am terrible at it myself. But have you ever gotten into a position where you think to yourself, I'm going to have to delay this, or I'm going to have to break my self-imposed structure in some way?
Yeah, unfortunately not. It would be reassuring for me to say that. I actually brought the release date of Citizen Sleeper 2 closer because February was so crazy this year. We managed to like drag it into January to get that end of January slot. But I think that's because of my background. So before I started making games at like 30, I worked in like theater and events doing design. I also worked in kind of writing as well. But yeah, I spent a lot of time as a freelance designer for exhibitions and theater. Wow. And the thing with exhibitions and theater is nobody delays them. Like nobody's like, oh, don't worry, it'll just be 6 months and we'll open this exhibition like next year. Or no one's like, yeah, we're just going to delay this show by months, right? It just doesn't happen. It would kill those industries. So it's kind of interesting to me that when you have that mentality of like, which I describe as like cut to fit when I'm making my games, you know, then you kind of like make certain decisions. And I'm not necessarily saying that that's applicable in AAA, but there certainly does seem like an element of that wouldn't hurt to have this idea that a timeline is set and the game has to be made within the timeline. But I think, you know, AAA is contending with standards that are just absolutely astronomical, and shareholders that expect absolutely insane profits, right? They don't expect something to be just a little bit profitable or to wash its face. Like with my games, like I can get away with like making the money back and a little bit on top and probably still keep going, right? Even if I just manage that low bar. But that's, as we've seen, that's like means closure for a studio if all they do is that. We've seen obviously BioWare get hit pretty hard with layoffs after Veilguard underperformed, but I mean, sold over 1 million copies, what, like almost 2 million copies?
Yeah, it was so, two, yeah.
You know, hard to, the standards are so high. And so, yeah, I guess like I have that mentality, but again, I it's hard for me to apply it to such a big machine. And I do feel for developers who are caught in the middle of it.
I have to say, I absolutely love hearing your insights on this stuff, though. It's really you're so clear-eyed about it, and I appreciate your point of view. Really awesome to hear. Christian, WB, I believe you were the one that, again, predicted something about the Wonder Woman game. I don't know. Superman, fuzzy in my memory.
Superman prediction says what? This bums me out. I like a lot of these studios games, and I was excited about a lot of these announced games that seem to be struggling now. Gareth, they mentioned the idea of the coalesce, things aren't coming together. And I find that in the reporting we get on some of the difficulties in these larger studios, we often hear things about, oh, well, the BioWare magic is going to save the day at the end, or the Valve magic comes in at the end and makes it happen. And I do wonder if AAA games now are just so big and harder to make than the 360 PS3 era, or maybe even the PS4 Xbox One era, that you just can't rely on that anymore. You had a system in place that worked for so long that now no longer works. And whether that's pushback toward crunch, which hopefully continues, or workers' rights and workers coming together. Hopefully that continues more, or just these things becoming so unwieldy that that last, like, here it comes, we're going to find the movie and editing, you know, approach to game design. It seems like that has become tenuous at best. And I'm really curious, maybe at Icon, you know, these large studios can get together and
Icon
figure out
shall save us.
A roadmap, you know?
You know, I don't, what? But you're right, Christian. It's all it all rests on the success of Icon,
which can't be delayed because it's an event.
Can't
so
be delayed.
Yeah, they're gonna figure it out. It seems like something is broken.
Yeah,
multiple things between costs, the human cost, and then also the organization of it. And I can't imagine all these moving parts needing to come together as someone's working on something else and concepting something else and to scope something else to get something in, and then you play it and you're like, that's terrible. It's like me cooking, not off a recipe, you know, like, oh, I can make a tart. No, I can't. Not without a recipe in front of me.
Yeah.
But it bums me out, especially Wonder Woman really bums me out. She is a character I love. The Nemesis system is a mechanic I love. License that out if you can't make it.
I'm shocked that that's the thing that hit the cutting room floor first. It's like, well, we can't do that. It's like, well, but that's the coolest part. I agree. Wonder Woman is a neat character, and I would be sad if we never see that game never sees the light of day. But who knows? Who knows what's next for WB? But it's more example of the whole industry being in this weird flux state. All right, let's talk about some great games. We got a lot of interesting games to talk about. We'll get into our playlists.
Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us.
Gareth, you have a number of interesting games on your playlist, including, I think, the biggest thing happening right now. But where would you like to start?
I'll say
biggest thing happening because your game just came out too.
It's fine. Let's start with the biggest. They have got the meta. They've got like 2 Metascore points on us, so that's fair enough.
I'm going to give them a 1-star just to try to equal it out.
Just drag it down. Kingdom Come Deliverance 2. So yeah, I've kind of emerged into the world blinking from the launch of my game. And immediately after, a giant RPG has arrived. I didn't really gel with the first game, but I saw so many interesting discussions about the RPG systems that I kind of put it on the company credit card and picked up a copy of Kingdom Come Deliverance 2 for quote-unquote research reasons. So that has been occupying a bit of my time definitely this week when I've had a moment to kind of like drag myself around a very realistic medieval farm and get drunk and wonder how the map works and marvel at the worst ever British accents I think I've ever encountered in a video game. If you're not British, you might not have the same experience, but it's truly something. The barmaid in the first pub is really... I've never heard somebody shift from like 5 different regions of the UK to Jamaica, India, and back in a single sentence. But
incredible.
Yeah, mixed feelings, but it's kind
Take
of amazing.
Take that Metascore.
Yeah, yeah. No, but it's kind of amazing that a game, to be honest, that a game like this can exist now. I love the idea of a million people buying this game on day one because it is an incredibly bizarre combination of medieval life simulator and very old-fashioned RPG mechanics, slightly wacky tone that's kind of like The Hangover, but with medieval knights. It's all over the place, but who doesn't love a AAA game with a lot of money that looks gorgeous, that is all over the place, versus one that's had all the edges sanded off? So yeah, I'm having fun with it. I don't know where it's going to land for me, but the moment that I think... I stop finding the weird accents, I'll probably drop off.
That's awesome. It's cool that I did not take to the first game, and I have not picked up the second. I don't think I will. But it's interesting. Do you think you are enjoying this one more than you enjoyed the first?
Yeah, definitely. I think the thing that got me was there was a really good review on Rock, Paper, Shotgun by a great writer called Edwin, who's a someone that I know, and he wrote this great review about the kind of speech mechanics and a lot of the like reputation systems. And I think that's the thing that kind of got me into thinking like, okay, yeah, maybe I'll try this one for professional reasons. So yeah, the fact that like how you dress, and then there's this really complex way in which your like skills affect your speech skills. So you have a speech skill, but then you have all these other skills. And so, for example, if you don't have a really high combat skill and then you try to intimidate somebody, then that will be like laughable. But also if that person is like a bandit who's like shaking you down and he's like obviously well armored, he's also not going to be intimidated just on the principle that he won't be intimidated. And I think when I'm a big fan of playing RPGs with a kind of speech focus, but I often get quite disappointed to find that if I just spec my speech score high enough in something like Starfield, it basically means I can just skip all the combat in the game by just clicking the option that's got like speech score 80 next to it.
Right.
And then they'll be like, actually, we're fine with you just walking through here.
Yeah, take anything you like.
Yeah, yeah. So it's nice to see a game where part of my strategy in the early part of it when you're quite poor is that I was like, I'm going to gamble with some dice to get enough money to buy a nice shirt so that I'll be well presented when I go to negotiate access to this wedding feast I need to get into. So there's this really fun kind of like emergent, very, very kind of D&D run by like a real rules heavy kind of DM, like someone who's really a real stickler. But there's something kind of charming about it. So I think that's what's getting me right now.
That's very cool. That's Kingdom Come Deliverance 2. What else is on your playlist?
I've also finally got chance to play The Thaumaturge, which is a game from last year that 11-Bit Studios published, who you'd know from Frostpunk and also the incredible Indica, which came out last year and I loved. And it's like, how to describe The Thaumaturge? It's like a CRPG Witcher game, except it's set in kind of like 18th century Poland, very, very historically specific, mostly in Warsaw. And you're kind of finding people's, like, you're investigating all of these things that are happening because of, like, demons. You can see these demons and nobody else can really see them. And it has these, like, turn-based battles. But it's almost like, a little like the game Black Book, which is quite a similar premise. A little like The Witcher, lots of investigation, but with turn-based combat. And it's just super, super historically rich. It's at a time when, like, Warsaw is being called, like, three different names by different groups, because it's like the Russians and Austro-Hungarians, and there's like a whole imperial conflict, and it's really rich material for like a kind of spooky, very like somber CRPG. So I've been really enjoying that one too. It's kind of, it's not always the most polished, but I think if you know it's what you expect from a game like this. Is, you know, it's made by a relatively small team, a polished team. But it's so, yeah, it's so rich with ideas and kind of like narrative. And yeah, it's got a vibe that I can't really compare to anything else.
Yeah, I think Rich Lovejoy came on and told us about this one. And I never checked it out, but I've heard other people rave about it, that it's so interesting and different. That's The Thaumaturge, Thaumaturge. Something on Gareth's playlist. What else you got?
My last one is Sky Caravan, which is a tiny little game I just ran into this week at total random. It's a little game on Steam about having a crew of people in a sky caravan in this kind of hand-drawn world. And it's just a kind of simple narrative game. But it has this really neat trick, which is the whole game is presented as if you're in this kind of ramshackle cockpit of this sky caravan. And the way you like make narrative choices is that this little machine pops up all these discs with like faces on them that represent like your mood and reaction. And you like slot one of those into this little machine, which like sucks it in and then like spits out the text. And when you get reputation up or down with characters, little like things hinge in at the side, little machines, and show like a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And it's got this really nice kind of, yeah, I don't know, quite charming and like polished feel to it, even though it's essentially just a kind of single branching narrative, right? Without even very complex choices or a little bit of resource management, just enough to keep your brain ticking over. But it's just a kind of 4-hour little story about these cute characters kind of flying around on this sky caravan, going to all these weird places, making deliveries and things. And I found it to be super zen and just kind of, I don't know, I just turned it on and just found myself like picking away at it, clicking away and just kind of chilling out with it. So yeah, it's nothing super complex, but it was working for me.
I love it. It has a demo on Steam as well if people want to check out Sky Caravan. Gareth, when you're head down and working hard on a game before it comes out, are you playing other games at that time, or is it sort of between projects that you get to be a gamer?
I mean, it's all the time really for me. I think It mostly comes from the fact that I was a critic for quite a few years, writing kind of freelance, never full time. And I just have this real curiosity for games that whenever something comes out and I start reading reviews, if anything at all sounds like it's interesting, I will buy it and play it. Even if I only play an hour of it, a couple of hours of it. For me, it keeps me fresh in terms of making games as well. And I always think, one of my biggest observations is like that this AAA games have so many ideas, more ideas than they have time to develop. And sometimes you can spot an idea in a AAA game and you can be like, I can make a video game from this idea, like my version of this idea. You know, things like the galaxy map in Mass Effect, right? It's like that could be a whole video game, easily could be a narrative video game. And it's those kind of things that get my brain ticking over. So games are so rich, especially AAA games. And sure, they have like this main narrative, something like Kingdom Come. You know, I don't love that main narrative. I don't really love this kind of like drunk blokes on holiday like vibe. But within the game, there's all kinds of like fun little things happening, or little mechanics or little twists that you might not find in any other game. So yeah, I think that's what kind of gets me keeping and playing games. But that means I don't finish a lot of games. I play a lot of little bits all over the place. And I think it's now between games where I actually get the chance to sit down and maybe take a shot at playing something all the way through just for me, not for work.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Love that. Christian Spicer, what is on your playlist?
Two games I want to bring to the show this week. The first one I've had for a while. I waited for it to come out on physical copy on Switch. And that is Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. Is its very succinct name. Man, if you know me, you know I have the box here with me, so I get all the games. It has X-Men, Children of the Atom, The Punisher. Yeah, I'm the guy who paid $80 for a Genesis cart of The Punisher, which is not an arcade perfect port, but love it. Marvel Superheroes, X-Men versus Street Fighter, Marvel versus Capcom, Marvel versus Capcom 2, Marvel Superheroes versus Street Fighter. So many of these games have come out over the years, but not in great arcade perfect ports. What this collection brings to the table is incredible versions of these games. It is that arcade version of The Punisher, which is a Ninja Turtles-esque side-scrolling brawler, and then the rest are all these fighting games that, in my opinion, have the best... I still think to this day the best looking version of Marvel characters in games. I love the pixel art versions of Capcom from this era and these versions of these Marvel heroes. Marvel Rivals is great. It does great things with 3D versions of these Marvel heroes, but these Marvel versus Capcom games, the pixel art I think is absolutely timeless, and the design of the characters is I think some of the best that's ever been done. And so I love being able to go back and revisit them. Marvel versus Capcom. I think Marvel Rivals owes a lot in its inspiration to Marvel versus Capcom in these versus games, where Marvel versus Capcom 2 especially is forever unbalanced. It is just a mess of a game with so many different fighters, and the idea that anyone can compete with anyone on a level playing field if both players have the equal skill is just not true, right? Someone is going to have a stronger character. And I like seeing that taken forward in games like Marvel Rivals now, or some of these games that allow fun to triumph tight balance in some ways. And I think these old fighting games represent some of the best of that. In this collection, the reason I wanted to bring it up this week is also has now been announced for Xbox. Before, it was only on Switch, PC, and PlayStation. I believe there were issues with porting the engine over onto Xbox. I don't think it's been... There's been some... I think some of the Mega Man games also have struggled. But it's coming to Xbox. It's a phenomenal collection. If you haven't played them, or you haven't played them in a very long time, I think it's excellent. I think the netcode, I'm no expert on it, certainly, but I think it feels pretty good. It felt pretty good from launch. People more attuned to that than I also gave it praises for its online local couch co-op. It's fun to play with my kids and just pull up our favorite characters and watch them jump around and do zany things. And you can simplify things a little bit. If you just want to keep see the cool stuff, you can kind of turn on the cool stuff buttons. You won't win any tournaments.
Are you playing it on Switch?
I am. Yeah, I'm playing it on Switch.
How is the? Are you playing with a pro controller or what are you playing?
I have a pro controller and I also have a fight stick.
Oh, you have a fight stick for Switch?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Cool.
And I also have turn on the cool buttons and just play in handheld mode.
Well, that's Marvel versus Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics.
Easy to remember.
Capcom will never not add another word to its title.
Which is actually the whole full title. Capcom will not actually add another word.
Yeah. What else is on your playlist?
I'm staying with Capcom and the open beta for Monster Hunter Wilds. I think when you're listening to this, it's still happening, but there's another one before release as well. So if you miss this one, you can jump into that one. I had missed the original beta or demo, whatever it was called before. I think I was out of town when that was happening. So I was very excited to jump in and play this time. I am playing on PS5. I don't know why I picked that platform, but I picked PS5 for my demo. And I took some notes because I want to make Lana proud. I'm going to say pronounce all the names wrong, but I wanted to be able to get some of the details right. Monster Hunter has never, as a huge PSP guy, huge fan of all of the consoles that Monster Hunter has been such a dominant IP on, Monster Hunter has always kind of been a blind spot to me. Lana and I played a decent amount with what, two releases ago, I think it was, and one of the expansions. But it's never been a game that's really got its hooks in me the way it has so many other people. This game, Monster Hunter Wilds, is built on the RE engine. And my goodness, there are moments in this game that are just stunning. The creature design, the monsters that you are hunting, unbelievable. So cool. I mean, they're massive. And one of them, Dashigama, I was hunting, I was doing the Alpha Dashigama hunt, and there's a pack of them. And they're,
sorry.
Thank you. Yeah. They're kind of like these bear dog things that are, you know, massive. And they have the hair that's animated, and there's a pack, and you're trying to separate them from the pack because taking on four of these things at once is near impossible, especially for someone at my skill level. And so you're using the environment and environmental traps, and then you can call an SOS flare to have hopefully real people come in, but if not, some NPC bots come in to help you do this, you know, kite and be able to take down these other enemies as you focus on the alpha. Super fun when all of that stuff clicks. And the monster design, I think, in Wilds is top tier aesthetically and also graphically how they look. There are other moments in the game where I'm walking around my little camp and it's just, you know, low res wood everywhere. Like there must be some limitations on how big this game could be on that engine. Cause it just seemed like there's a discrepancy between, oh, these are the hero shots. And this is like, no one's really looking at this table with all the potions on it, but it feels a little jarring, especially after coming from some of these epic, you know, monster fights. So what I did is I fought the Chatacabra, an Alpha Dashaguma, and there was one other one that I did where did I write it down? I don't remember. But this demo also has an Arkveld in it, and you can explore the Windward Plains monsters that were in the original beta, and then they added a few more, and you get the first story mission. These games are so complex. Gareth, I don't know if you ever got into hunting monsters, but they are, I think of that you're talking about, there's a million games in a AAA game. I play Monster Hunter, and I'm like, oh, just my camp life could be a game. You know, just my potion making could be a game. Just my resource farming after I take down a monster could be a game. And I'm not sure if Monster Hunter Wilds will be the one that grabs me, if any of them ever will. But I really respect they don't dumb down what they're doing to try to hit a more mainstream approach. No Monster Hunter game, or I should say Monster Hunter Wilds, does not feel like Monster Hunter's approach at Final Fantasy 16, if that makes sense, Jeff. They're not trying to round the edges to make this a bigger franchise. The controls are as complex as ever. The weapons feel different between a huge sword or an axe or dual wielding two daggers. There's so much to master.
I think that's what they're selling, though, too. Those games, a selling point is that you have to really master it. You know, I think that's what people go to those games for. So,
yeah, you're not wrong. My only other hang up, but this has been true on the series for forever, is the beast doesn't have a health bar. Mm. You see the damage you're causing. You see, like, right. I'm using this little dinky attack and it's like one is flying off. And then I can change up something. And I'm like, oh, now I'm getting six. So I know I'm doing more damage, but I don't know how much I'm doing.
Right.
And I know some hardcore fans of the community think that that is too. They think that makes the fights more compelling because you don't know when it's over. And the animal itself will have tells, like it'll limp or it'll show damage, but they kind of like that. You got to stay in the fight the whole time. I sometimes think, oh God, when is this going to be over? I'm getting my butt kicked. But it feels like they're doing a lot right in this. I would predict, really going out on a limb here, that this game's going to be a hit for Capcom.
Yeah, it seems like a sure thing. All right, that's Monster Hunter Wild's open beta on Christian's playlist. Let me tell you about a game that has not been released yet, but there's a demo available. This was brought to my attention by a friend of the show, Dan Jevons, who said, hey, Jeff, you got to try this. I think it's in your wheelhouse. It's called Neon Spellstorm. This is an indie game that some people have described as Hades meets Vampire Survivor, two games I love. And I can see why people would say that. The game that it made me think of is only for olds. It's called Zaxxon, a game I loved as a young kid. Zaxxon is, if you remember it, an old classic arcade game, is in this weird isometric view where you're only going in one direction, but everything is sort of skewed, like you're off into a distant tilted horizon. And that's how Neon Spellstorm works as well. And the color palette reminds me of old CGA monitors as well that I played Zaxxon on at home when I was a wee boy. It's sort of got this like pink. I mean, it's called Neon Spellstorm, so I guess you could infer that. But it's got this cool pink and blue, you know, the old CGA color palette. And you are sort of building this ramp, this runway that you are running down. And much like Vampire Survivor or Hades, there are monsters being spawned and going all around you. And you defeat them and they drop little orbs of experience that if you collect enough of them, you'll level up. And if you level up, you'll get a choice of three randomized upgrades that will change your playstyle and give you boosts and bonus and boons. All very cool and fun. I think for this, the way it changes up that formula of Vampire Survivor and Hades, for that matter, is that it is this constant progression forward. And as you move forward and it sort of constructs the runway in front of you, building it out of blocks that are sort of magnetized to the next level that you're walking towards, it is doing the same in reverse behind you. So the pathway that you've just been walking is dissolving and falling away. And if you didn't grab the orbs of experience that were behind you and you move too far forward, they fall away and are become inaccessible for you. So that is a cool change, because if you've ever played Vampire Survivor, you know that much of that game is circling and leaving areas and then coming back to them to pick up all the orbs that you created in the destruction that you left in your wake. So the fact that it sort of adds a little bit of tension of don't go too far forward, or think about if you're going to go too far forward, and it's constrained. The pathway is kind of narrow and there's objects in your way that will force you around certain pathways or bottleneck you and allow the enemies to swarm and you know, cause problems for you. I think the aesthetic is awesome. I think the powers are really interesting and cool. I hope the game, as it gets closer to release, can convey its power-ups in a more cogent, clearer, more emphatic way, because as I leveled up and got these three options, very often I was confused as to, I really had a hard time parsing what the upgrade actually did, because it'll be like, ice blast leads to sonic, leads to explosion. And I'm like, ah, what does that mean? And then the other one would be like ice blast leads to laser bounce. And I was like, I don't know exactly what that, what is communicated to me. But I think the game has a lot of promise and is really fun if you're into those kinds of games as I am, these survivor likes. This one twists up the formula, I think, more than most and to interesting effect. So that's Neon Spellstorm, which is only available as a demo so far, but has a 2025 anticipated release window. All right, I want to talk a little bit about Citizen Sleeper 2, Starward Vector, with Gareth, because I'm enjoying the game immensely, even though I hate how it makes me feel sometimes.
And sorry.
I mean, you've added, I love the first game as well. And this one, you've added this stress system that gives me stress. And it's not usually a feeling that I seek out in games. And I'm wondering what your position is regarding putting the player into uncomfortable places. It seems like you certainly don't shy away from it. In fact, you are eager to do so.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not necessarily looking to make the player uncomfortable, but looking to engage them, I think. And I think there's, you know, difficulty is such a powerful way of engaging players, I think, when done right. And I think in the first Citizen Sleeper, I felt like I was very happy with the vibe of it. I think it has this very particular progression arc that I kind of worked on, where you're picking up you're trying to get this drug, the stabilizer, for people who don't know, to like get yourself back up to the level. And then you start declining and declining. And it's about the kind of tension of knowing that decline's coming and knowing that, oh God, tomorrow is going to be worse and the day after that is going to, and that kind of gets you into the reason I'm doing that is not because I want to make the player miserable and put them in a decline. It's because I want to get them into this headspace, the emotional headspace of the sleeper, and therefore bring them into the world, right? Use that as a tool to bring them into the world. So for Citizen Sleeper 2, I really am a big fan of stories about improvisers and about kind of like characters. I've never been really like a big superhero fan, I think, because I always like the idea of characters who aren't any more powerful than anybody else in the movie or the TV show, but they're just a bit luckier. Like the kind of Indiana Jones thing of like, he's never the biggest guy. He's never like the smartest guy, but he's the guy who somehow gets out. He somehow gets lucky, or maybe he's smart, but he's got this very specific kind of smarts that comes with kind of noirish storytelling. And pluck. I guess that's the kind of, pluck. Maybe he's the pluckiest guy. So I guess I'm asking you to be plucky in Citizen Sleeper 2 and kind of, I want the player to respond to like these stressful situations where they don't have full control, you know, of everything that's happening. And we're used to in games having maybe the ability to like have an optimum outcome and almost like also an optimum setup, right? Like our perfect setup, everything's ready. We're ready to go. We're going to execute. And I wanted players to have to deal with, I haven't got enough, I'm not ready, I'm going to have to do this right now, and I know it's going to be bad, but I'm going to try and get through it, and I'm going to come out the other side, and we're going to keep going. And that's the kind of emotional journey I wanted for players. So that's what I'm trying to do to you.
No, it's exactly how I feel. And it's not, like I said, you know, oftentimes I go into games to live out the power fantasy, to feel OP, to feel like, ah, this is awesome because I'm mowing down the enemies or I'm leaping, you know, the chasm or whatever it is. And Citizen Sleeper, as you so well articulated, doesn't allow me to feel that way. I'm always in the first game too, I'm always feel like I don't quite have enough. I'm never quite where I want to be. And every decision is, I have to weigh every decision and oh man, and failure is a big part of the game as well, which I think is a bold design decision, right? Because players don't like to fail, right? And you are asking players to fail in Citizen Sleeper 2 frequently, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm trying to make a deal with players, which is like, hey, don't worry, if you fail, I'm going to make it interesting. And yeah. I want the players to come out of it with a story. And I think, you know, in Citizen Sleeper 1, that story was about what path did you take through the Erlin's Eye? Like, who did you side with? What ending did you find? You know, how did who were your favorites? Like, I think for Citizen Sleeper 2, I wanted this, like, I wanted everyone to have a story where everybody at some point hit like real difficulty. They hit like some, like, it broke bad, basically. I wanted everyone to have this mechanical story, not just like a story that I'm narrating, but actually like a story that they're narrating as well, where they go on a contract and it doesn't quite work out. And then they realize like this is not going to play out well, and they have to try and make a call on whether they, you know, how they actually negotiate that circumstance. And then they kind of live through it. And I don't like fade to black and say, try again. And I don't give them a chance to roll back their save. And I say, okay, let's keep going, because that's now like the fuel for the bounce back, right? There's this phrase that ended up being really important for Citizen Sleeper 2 in development, which is this idea of bouncing back, that I want to give the player the opportunity to like bounce back against this difficulty and find their like their way to deal with it. And I felt like that was kind of just the emotional experience that I wanted, because that's the emotional experience of the sleeper in the game, which is kind of like, you know, immediately on the run at the start of the game, immediately on the back foot. And that part, you know, the initial part of the game is intentionally quite challenging to immediately try and set that expectation of like, hey, yeah, you can't, you're not going to get a perfect outcome. There's no perfect way through this thing, but you know, there's going to be a story and it's going to be exciting and it's going to, you know, I'm a huge fan of, Into the Breach. I don't know if you guys ever played Into the Breach.
Yeah, I love that game. Yeah.
And the thing I love about Into the Breach is the way, rather than saying like, here's some enemies, how are you going to kill them? It says, here's a situation that's going to go, if you don't do anything, that building's getting destroyed. You're going to get this knocked off your power grid. This guy's going to die. This guy's going to die. What are you going to do about it? And then they put the emphasis on you, and you're trying to come up with, you know, sometimes you can get the perfect setup, but you're trying to come up with a way in which you're trying to do that. And then sometimes you have to make hard decisions. You're like, okay, that skyscraper is going to have to come down because, you know, that's the only thing I can do right now. And I don't have enough power in the power grid. And this is what I really wanted for Citizen Sleeper 2 is I love that game. I love the way that when you're playing Into the Breach, a lot of the game happens in your head. You know, you click kind of quite rarely in a way, because you spend a lot of time just looking and thinking. And that's what I kind of wanted for Citizen Sleeper 2, is a game like that, but with way more narrative, way more storytelling, all the writing put on top of that to give it kind of like a slightly different feel to something like Into the Breach.
That bounce back notion that you were talking about, it feels very tabletop role playing game, right? You know, as somebody who's done a lot of DMing myself, one of the hardest things for players, I think, to wrap their heads around is that failure is good. Right, that it's an opportunity for storytelling, and that there's never been a good story in the history of time that didn't involve the main characters doing something wrong or failing in some way, because that's what the second act is about. Right? That's you know, and but I think it's a different notion, even more of a different notion, allowing a single person who's sitting in front of their computer to feel that and not feel like you're pushing them away from the game, you know, like communicating. And what I'm trying to say is I think that the Citizen Sleeper 2 in particular does such a good job of feeling like you've got me, right? Like you said, if I fail, or when I fail, there will be interesting things that come of it. And it's not something to recoil from or feel like I need to restore my save, as you said.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing, it totally is, yeah, drawing on that tabletop idea. And there's this piece of DMing advice, which I'm sure you've heard, which is like, be a fan of the players, right? And I always really like this. And I think that's what I try to do in Citizen Sleeper, is I try to give this sense of like, okay, yeah, I'm going to push you. I'm going to push hard. There's going to be times when like, you're not going to see where, how you're going to get out of the situation. But I want you to. I really want, I don't want you to fail. I want you to actually overcome that and step over it and find that path through. And I'm giving you tools, right? Like the lowest chance in Citizen Sleeper is a 50-50, even with a one. And my trick in the game is like, I make that feel bad to like, a one looks really scary. And then when you put the one in the action and the game's like, yeah, this is scary. This is a scary moment. Hit that button, see what happens. But at the end of the day, it's a 50-50. If you're playing XCOM, you might have like a 20% shot. Right. They don't do anything to make that 20% shot feel bad, right? they're just kind of like, oh, 20% or 95%. It's all presented the same way. And because of that, I think they sometimes you just go for a 20% shot because you're like, yeah, whatever, it's 20% shot. That sounds pretty good. People are so crazy with probability sometimes, yeah, you know?
Yeah.
We get bug reports where people are like, you're cheating the dice. And it's like, nope, it's just dice, just probability, my friend. There's no cheating. It's that thing of like, I want to engage with the emotional aspect of dice. And I think that's something I really learned from tabletop gaming is like, dice have this incredible ability to represent everything from like your own internal capabilities, like the character's capabilities. Can I do this? Versus the world pushing against you. Like, can this be done? Mm. And versus just a wider idea of like fate or chance or like, you know, is this what's supposed to happen? Or like how, you know, how can we negotiate that? And it just plays into me something that's actually like very core to human experience is we all have these like series of experiences, and at the end of the day we like come home and we tell somebody a story about like, this is what happened to me today and this is what it means.
I
really love that. So that's kind of I'm trying to engage with that in video games, and that's the kind of, it's not like I have all the answers. For me, that's the experiment of Citizen Sleeper. That's what it's been about. It's been about how can I bring this over into video games, this thing that I think is really special in tabletop, and that can totally be part of video games too.
That's awesome.
I think for games for so long, too, just the term or idea of failure has meant something very specific that is different than other forms of storytelling.
Yeah, it means game over.
Yeah, it means literal game over. And it means more money in that you need to, you know, pay more, or you've lost time now because you got to redo. I failed trying to take down that monster in Monster Hunter Wilds. Now I need to do it again. And it is punitive. And I think, you know, Jeff, you mentioned in storytelling, act two, it's not, you hit act two and it's like, well, show's over. Deborah went the wrong way. She got murdered by the monster.
Hands in carbonite, man. That's it. What are we going to do now?
Yeah. Over. End of story. And seeing not only from a narrative standpoint, overcoming setback or challenge, I'm trying to use a different term, but I think, Gareth, as you're attempting or doing in Citizen Sleeper 2, and I think a fair amount in Citizen Sleeper 1 as well.
Well, it's interesting though. In the first one, I felt like by the end of the game, I was pretty powerful and I didn't have that stress. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Christian, but I just think it's interesting that there's been a progression, I think, into the second game. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say the idea of making grit a mechanic instead of a fail state. And a lot of times games have that grit moment or getting over something or overcoming something as a cutscene. You know, your character does something epic and then a truck blasts through the wall and they're hanging and they're gonna, you know, and that's the overcome moment. And how they can make, how games can make the player involved in that and make that exciting. You know, when I'm playing a tabletop game, most of the time, a lot of our fun comes from whoopsie daisies, not, I rolled this, I got this, here we go. And I love seeing that in games, even though I talked about last week in Citizen Sleeper 2, I definitely feel the anxiety of like, this is a crap situation. But I think it's fascinating from a design perspective of games and narrative and how you can make that mechanic or that experience playable and interactive, which is the hallmark of games, and not something that you just observe.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's also been the process between Citizen Sleeper 1 and 2 is like trying to calibrate, you know, Citizen Sleeper 1 was an initial experiment in that mode and bringing certain ideas over, like clock. I was, you know, super interested in bringing clocks over from tabletop, and clocks became really important to Citizen Sleeper because it's something that I loved using at the table. I love putting a clock down without a name in front of my players and then just start ticking it up when things happen as a consequence and just watching them freak out because they have no idea what's going to happen when this clock gets filled. As I said earlier, I am a trickster of a DM, but the that was, so I started to introduce that, right? Dice, clocks. But for me, one of the things I wanted to do was take some, maybe try and reach a bit wider to players who need like more mechanical aspects to get into the role playing, who need to be pushed actually, who are too good at min-maxing. And I wanted to kind of test those people and try and encourage them to engage with the, with what I'm proposing to them. So I know that sometimes like that's not going to land, and definitely, you know, it can be, it's not like players, I'm not like looking at players and being like, oh, you didn't engage with this, like that's your failing. It's like, it's an experiment, and it's something I'm trying to figure out. And it's a process that, you know, can be, I can't balance the game for everybody. I'm trying really hard to DM the game for thousands of people from a great distance.
That's crazy.
But the, you know, I think that's what I'm most happy with in Citizen Sleeper 2 is when I play it, I still have moments where I'm like on a contract and I'm like, like I did the anniversary stream, and I wasn't really anniversary release stream on Steam, and I wasn't really paying attention, and I just like chucked a dice in action and hit go, and I was like, the moment that I saw that had failed and what it had done, I saw okay, I got one stress there, and I suddenly did some calculations, and I was like, oh, I'm so screwed now. Like I just passed the Rubicon. Like it just, and it, you know, and I made the game. So for me, that's the kind of thing that I get excited about, systems and the way they can talk, and the way that they can help tell a story, I think is really fun. And it's always a balance for me because I'm not a super systemic. I'm not like a big sim player, and I don't want to make like just sim stuff, but I find my inspirations come from kind of opposite ends. And I often find myself a little disappointed that like, oh, this quite narrative game doesn't use more systems to tell its story, or this sim game doesn't really like have a good enough story. It's like when the systems play out, it's like actually it's a bit dry, there's no characters, you know, and there's very few games in between that kind of do both. And so I guess that's a space that I find myself exploring totally.
I mean,
War Tales is an interesting game that's kind of in that zone, if you've played that.
I like that game a lot. Yeah,
and I remember in that game, like I got a this was like early in the development of Citizen Sleeper 2, I played that game, and I like recruited a wolf, you know, while I was exploring, and this wolf became like an integral part of my team of like mercenaries as we were going around. And then one battle I realized that like I had a choice, we'd messed up and it was going to be the wolf that was going to die, or it was going to be one of my team. And I realized like, okay, the wolf is going to be the one that dies. And they do this beautiful thing in War Tales where the wolf's body becomes an item in your inventory, and if you use it, you can put a little grave in the world, and you can get your keyboard and you can type whatever you want like on that grave. And so I took this wolf to like a nice little spot by a tree, by a stream, and I buried it, and I wrote its name on the grave. And that was all systems, right? At no point did the game like lean in and try and tell me that story.
Right.
And that for me is really powerful. And I, you know, for me, I guess personally, I want to just lean in just a little bit. I want to do that DM thing of just like describing the water and the tree and the weather on that day when you bury the wolf, right? That's where for me there's that little bit of juice that could just be injected in there. So I'm always kind of playing in that zone, I think.
I love hearing you talk about it. It's fascinating, and you're so articulate about it. It really makes me excited that you're working in this space, and I can't wait to see your long career continue. Very, very cool stuff. All right. Well, we've talked a lot about tabletop games. Let's talk about some tabletop games real quick. But first, we're going to take a quick break for a sponsor. We'll be right back right after this. All right. Let's carve out a little bit of tabletop time.
Right now.
All right, Gareth, what has been hitting your table? What do you want to talk about with the tabletop time?
Yeah, I kind of split my difference here because I wasn't sure when you asked me, like, do I play board games, like how tabletop we were going to get.
Deep as you want, baby.
I'm at two opposite ends here, really, because I have been playing Everdell with my 9-year-old daughter, which is a little tableau building board game. Where you kind of like assemble you have to like put on parades. You're basically like drafting from a set of cards, and you're getting all these nice little resources that are all like little plastic things in
juicy
buckets.
Berries.
It's so delightful. Good. And it's so good for kids, but it has, it's incredible to see. I think the thing that has been really interesting for me is I don't think it's the first type of those like engine building, tableau building games where like, okay, you know, what you do is you're like, I want this character because when I get this character, every time I take a house, I get like one extra berry. And then I can spend that berry on this thing that will give me like three berries. And then, and my daughter's never played these games before. And just watching her like slowly figure out like this mad machine where she was like, oh, I've got these two cards. And then if I play this and this and this, it was so cool. So it was just this really nice experience of kind of seeing how this stuff starts to bed into your brain and how satisfying it is to like, it made me think of Balatro in a way, like that engine building mentality of like, oh, I can see how I can build this really crazy like mousetrap cause and effect system that's gonna win me the game. So that's been really cool.
Yeah, it's amazing to see how much of a hit Everdell has become. It's such a beautiful game. You know, it's got all these anthropomorphized animals, and the art is gorgeous. And you build a little tree house kind of thing on as part of the board, and so it's got a lot of table appeal. But it also, it's kind of doing stuff that a lot of games do. It just does it really well. But it's in my collection too. I love Everdell a lot. I have not introduced it to my son yet. He's 8. Maybe hearing your experience with your daughter, maybe I'll do that.
It's quite tricky. But I think the thing that also I really liked about it over other tableau builders, or it's sometimes the case, but sometimes they can be quite abstract. Like you have all this nice art, but then it's like, oh, it doesn't really connect with what's happening in the theme. Mm. And one of the key parts of my daughter's game was like a pirate ship. And the pirate ship could like get you any resource, right? And so this quickly became like this discussion where you're like, oh, we could send the pirate ship to get the resource, right? And so there's just, I think that really helped for a 9-year-old, that it wasn't just this abstract idea, but actually in her head, there was this little like community of animals all like going off and doing their jobs. And it all kind of made sense in terms of like the card abilities and things, which is, not always the case in those games.
Yeah. Great game. Everdell is what it's called. What else do you want to talk about?
Yeah, I've also been running a long campaign of Eberron D&D 5e with my tabletop group. This has been over the past like 18 months now. It's been running for sometimes weekly, on and off. This was like a thing that I set myself because, I got so sick of being told what D&D is, having never really played it. So I got into tabletop quite late. Only really in the past kind of 6-7 years, and got in through Blades in the Dark and, much more contemporary role-playing games. And just, when you enter the tabletop scene, everyone's screaming about D&D. It's like a room of people screaming at each other about this one game. And you're like, I haven't played it. And you take in so much information about it. And then I was just like, I just need to play it. I just need to run it, see what happens. And I knew that Eberron, which if people don't know is like, the kind of Dishonored-y, like a kind of modern fantasy version with like less gods and more kind of steampunk. It's got this amazing like flying city of towers called Sharn, which my adventurers just got to. And I'm having so much fun, like basically getting them into cyberpunk kind of like plots between different counselors who are like playing off against dragon houses. Who are like, they're just kind of like mega corporations trying to get my PCs in trouble. So that's been really fun. But yeah, just like running D&D for a long time just felt like something. If I'm going to make tabletop games and if I'm going to make video games inspired by tabletop games, you kind of got to do it. You've got to learn what this monster actually is and get in the guts of it. And yeah, I have a lot of opinions now about D&D that it's, the funniest thing I found is that everything everyone's screaming about D&D is simultaneously true. It seems like it's all true. It is like just a combat wargaming machine, and yet it is this incredible storytelling capability. It has has so many things going on that actually you just feel totally free to just pick and choose and calibrate your own version of it. So yeah, I've been finding it interesting. As much as the company that runs it do seem to just fall into pitfalls constantly. It is an interesting game to run.
I've heard you reference Blades in the Dark as being an inspiration for some of the systems in Citizen Sleeper. Do you still prefer that system to D&D, or what if you were going to start a campaign today, would you do D&D again, or what would you think?
Yeah, I'm missing Blades. There's so many good Fortune the Dark games, and I love how tight Blades is. I do find, like, the thing I don't like about D&D most of all is the way that it makes my players, like, expect combat all the time, mm-hmm. because they get a new ability and they want to use it in combat. And actually, right. we've been having so much fun I've been kind of testing them a bit in Shan by basically having no combat, just having like a lot of murder mystery and kind of like investigation gameplay, and trying to just stretch that out a bit and see if I can find something interesting there. But I think Blades just plays so nicely into also like low prep game. I think like D&D's so heavy on the prep. It's such hard work. Yeah. And building battle maps and encounters and stuff is also just a bit of a nightmare when you're busy. The thing I love about Blades is you can just look at the map and pick a spot on it and see which factions are there. And then you could just start rolling dice and you can get into a heist. So I'm eager to do that. I've also was on the playtest for Austin Walker's Realis, which is like a new tabletop game by the games journalist Austin Walker. Yeah. Also actual play podcaster, if you know Friends at the Table.
Yeah.
And that game's like a dice free sentence based game, so players have sentences that like have different levels of reality depending on how specific they are. It's quite complex, but also quite simple, very story forward. And I think that's actually the game that I would want to run my next campaign in, because it's almost like the absolute antithesis of D&D. It's like no dice. No, there can be combat, but no combat abilities, no special combat system. It's all about you start with these like archetypal characters, like a berserker who might have a sentence about them that's like, I win every fight I start. And you can use that in the game to like make things happen. But then as that character grows, you add like that sentence gets stronger, but it gets like caveats added to it. So like, I win every fight I start, like, you know, when I'm angry. And then that makes it more powerful, but more specific. And so it's all about honing down these archetypes into very specific characters by the end of the story. So I'm super interested to play more in that space.
Wow, that sounds so cool. I was not aware of that game. Very, very cool. Christian Spicer, I know that you have a board game to talk about as well.
Different type of game. It's called Otrio, and it is complex. Why did my brain just blank on what the actual game is called? Tic-tac-toe. Yes, complex tic-tac-toe. Tic-tac-toe, always rigged, right? You know, if you play it a certain way, it's always going to go a certain way. Everybody knows tic-tac-toe. Otrio has a similar-based grid, but you can play – if you play with – it's four colors. And if you play two-player, each player manages two colors at a time. If you play two-player, each person only having one color – I think it's whoever goes first will always win unless the other person makes a mistake. So even in the rules, two player, you are managing two colors each. You can play three player or four player. And instead of just X's and O's and tic-tac-toe, you have multiple pieces, a big circle, a medium circle, and then a tiny little peg. And so it creates multiple win scenarios. You can win by having three big circles, or maybe it's four. I should have the board in front of me. I don't. You can win by having the four or the big circles go all the way across, medium circles go all the way across or diagonal, or the little pegs, or big, medium, small. And so you can build it out a bunch of different ways, which adds that layer of complexity when you're trying to keep track of what the other players are doing on the board. So it requires focus and engagement in a way that something like tic-tac-toe while you're waiting for dinner on a kid's menu doesn't. And it's fascinating because I have found the number of times I think I've lost. Well, one, I think I am, you know, when you don't lose, you're undefeated. Against my oldest, I am only defeated. I don't think I've managed to beat her. And sometimes they are silly mistakes where I'm like, oh, I lost track of her little peg for the blue color. And other times I'm out hustled. And I think a game like this that is so easy to play and easy to explain, you just got to, you know, tic-tac-toe. You got to get your what sits in a row, but adds the layer of the complexity and the focus of paying attention to what everyone else is doing. It shines. I think it's probably best with three or four players versus two with two colors each, because if you're playing two with two colors each, you can kind of, you know, you're playing with an ally oh, so I'm going to be blue and I'm going to intentionally do this to block her green, but what I'm really trying to do is set up my yellow for the win kind of thing. But when you're playing with three or four people, there is such a beautiful chaos happening on the board where it feels like the Princess Bride negotiation over poison in a cup, where it's like, are you trying to win? Or are you trying to prevent her from winning? Are you trying to prevent me? If you put that there, you know, I can put this here, but they clearly know that I can put, and then you talk yourself out of doing anything. And then my oldest beats me. It's a simple little game that I think is great for adults, but also kids, and really works for creating that focus and attention. And I think in our world of short attention spans, something like a game like Otrio really shines in honing in on, like, you gotta keep your eye on the board or you're gonna get steamrolled. It's fun.
It sounds great. I'm sold. I think my daughter would absolutely love that game. She loves tic-tac-toe, but it's reached that point where it's just like, it's a stalemate. Every game is a stalemate. So,
Jeff, I think you're muted, my friend.
I said always a tie.
Tic-tac-toe is always a tie.
Yeah, always a tie. Otrio, somebody screws up. Yeah.
Otrio is not. Otrio is Christian loses.
My son, who's eight, getting into Pokemon. I was never into Pokemon cards, but I was into Magic the Gathering. And so he was like, Daddy, can we play Pokemon? We played some Pokemon. I actually appreciated the mechanics of Pokemon in a way I never learned to them. So we played some Pokemon card games. He has this Battle Arena like boxed set. And we played some, and I was like, we should play some Magic the Gathering. He's like, I'll play Magic the Gathering. So I introduced him to Magic the Gathering for the first time. I realize I have an absurd amount of Magic the Gathering from exactly 2010 to 2012. So that's like the window. It's like, oh, it's pretty clear when I was super into this game. It's been a minute. So I had like unopened core sets from 2010 and all these things. I have massive amounts that I've just been hauling from home to home as I moved.
College fund is what apparently you had.
Yeah. Anyway, introduced Magic the Gathering to him. It has been a huge hit. You could go to our dining room right now and the entire table is covered with Magic the Gathering cards because my son's all super, super excited. He's like, how many of these do you have, Dad? I don't want to tell him that like the game has changed, but we've been having so much fun playing Magic the Gathering. He's super into it. And I don't think, I think their recommended age range is 12 or 13 or something. Eight, he's grokking it. It's great. As long as you can read and you have sort of some understanding of numbers, I think it's pretty accessible game. And maybe there's some gruesomeness to it that you may not want for a younger kid, but it's been a blast. It's been so much fun playing Magic the Gathering with my son. The other game I want to talk about is a completely different, not a high level strategy game at all, but a fun party game that we've been playing a bunch as well. It's called That's Not a Hat. I don't know if you guys have heard of this one. It's a pure memory game in that it is going to mock you for having a terrible memory. I have a terrible memory, but the whole point of this game, and which is what I say to anybody when I pull this out, is you're not going to be good at this, and that's the point. Like, so the idea of That's Not a Hat is the only components to this game is a deck of cards that have simple line drawings of objects. So it'll be a roller skate or a pizza or whatever it is. It's a million different things, but the most simplistic line drawing that makes it absolutely abundantly clear what you're looking at, a watch, whatever. Everyone has one card in front of them face up. Everybody can see what they have. As the game starts, one person picks up a new card. So you have one more card than people. They say, oh, look, it's an eraser. You put it down, and then you flip over the card that you started with so it is face down. On the back of that card, it has an arrow that points to either left or right, telling you which direction you're going to pass that card to. You pass it that direction, and you say, this is a roller skate. And that person can say, thank you for the roller skate, or that's not a roller skate. If they say thank you for a roller skate, they put it as their new card, and they flip their other card over, and say, this is a balloon, whatever it was. And they pass it the direction it's told. So very quickly, all the cards will be upside down, but no new cards are entering the game until someone says, that's not a balloon or whatever. At which point you reveal it, you find out who was right, and whoever was wrong gets a point. You try to have the fewest points. The thing about that's not a hat is that you quickly realize how terrible your brain is at everything, because it is a closed system. There's no new information coming until someone stops the game. And yet you so quickly lose track of literally everything. And it is hilarious and fun because you'll get a new card. You'll have lost, you know, you'll have told someone that's not a whatever and you were wrong. And so you have to get a new card. So you get a new card. You know the card that was in front of you. You see your new card. It's like, oh, an apple. You put it down and then you go, okay, now I need to pass my old, wait, what was that? I have absolutely no idea what my old card was, even though I just knew. And so it is this hilarious thing of, you know, somebody going, you know, this is an apple. And you go, I thought I had the apple. I thought I was the one with the apple, because it's going so quickly and it's going different directions that you just get completely flummoxed very fast. And it is a blast. This is a game that I find very, very fun. And you're laughing out loud because it gets to someone and you see in their face, they have no idea what their card is. And they just go, this is a pizza. And you're like, no, it's not. And then you flip it over and it was a pizza. And you're like, how did you do it? And you know, it's very, very hilarious. A very inexpensive game. It's called That's Not a Hat. So we gave you the full gamut of board game complexities and weight, as they call it. And that's going to do it for this episode of DLC. We do have parting gifts coming up, so stick around for those. But my goodness, what a fun time. Gareth, Damian Martin, thank you for being here. Really just absolutely loved hearing your perspective on games and game design. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been such a fun chat, and I love everything you're kind of covering, the breadth. I'm going to take all those board game recommendations right back to my daughter. She's going to absolutely love these games. So yeah, really cool to have that broad range covered.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Tell folks where they can keep up with you and the things you're doing and how they can get Citizen Sleeper 2 and anything you'd like to plug.
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, definitely Citizen Sleeper 2. If you found anything I said at all interesting, probably you'll find it at least a little bit interesting. And buying it will allow me to continue making interesting things, I hope. So you can get that on Steam. It's on Game Pass. It's on PlayStation 5 and Switch 2. You can also buy it on Xbox if you're not a Game Pass person, but you are an Xbox person. You can find me.
Switch TOO, by the way. He wasn't revealing that it's now on Switch 2.
No, I mean, it will presumably, who knows? I have no inside information. I'm afraid no dev kits here in the background of this shot. So no. You can find me on Blue Sky. That's pretty much the main place I hang out because it's a bit more chill there. I'm Gareth Damian Martin there at Jump Over the Age. You can also subscribe to my newsletter in case you don't like social media and you just want an email every couple of months when something cool happens. That's Jump Over the Age at Substack. It's probably jumpovertheage.substack.com, I imagine, but you know, you can search these things. And that's it. You'll pretty much find me in those places.
Awesome. Very cool. Christian Spicer, what about you? What do you got going on this week?
Same, except for, you know, not making awesome video games, but otherwise exactly the same. I write about awesome video games in a conversational newsletter that you can also find on Substack at christianspicer.substack.com. I've started on the next one. You know, they come out every couple of weeks or so. I always do my best to get back to everybody that replies to me. I love that back and forth engagement to it. I started on one, but now I'm really kind of just infatuated with the Switch 2 TWO's potential mouse controller. The patents came out for that. We have seen they're now public for all of the things that might do. And I'm really excited, but I'm also maybe I should just wait until April and Nintendo tells me what they can do. But that's what's happening with the current newsletter is I'm wrestling with following my passion of speculation or writing about what I've already started a a newsletter about. I'm also on Blue Sky, Christian Spicer, and this show is also on Blue Sky as DLC Hype Train. If folks want to ping us there, they can.
Yes, I'm also on Blue Sky at Jeff Canata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. I have other shows for you to check out, including the Film Cast, talking about movies and TV shows. I do a comedy science show called We Have Concerns, and also the book club, the DLC book club with Lana Bashinsky. We just put out our first episode for the 8th novel in the Tales of the Malazan Book of the Fallen by Steven Erikson, which is called Toll the Hounds. And I am in love with the series, and you should hop on and read along with us. You can find it as a video show on my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/KanataJeff, or as an audio show if you are a patron to this here podcast. All right, let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts.
Hey, give us a suggestion of what to do this week. Give us a parting gift. This is your parting gift.
Gareth, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
Yeah, so this summer I discovered a wonderful book as I've been trying to get back into fantasy. I always feel like I overlook fantasy, more of a science fiction person myself. And I picked up The Black Tongue Thief by Christopher Bullman. It's like a D&D adventure narrated by the most kind of like grumpy and humorous rogue that you could imagine. It's really, really well written. Not surprising that Christopher Bullman is a kind of like used to do a Renaissance Fair stand-up comedy routine, supposedly. It does have that vibe, but it's also actually has a really kind of like rich world building. It's a world where there's kind of these goblins who are just the most disturbing creatures that are massing at the shores of humanity. But there's all kinds of conflicts between different groups, and it's got a kind of dark fantasy side, but it's also, yeah, very, very funny. And then just the past couple of weeks, I've been reading Daughter's War, which is the prequel that came after. You could start with either, I think, but that's a bit darker. Again, like really beautifully written, completely different tone of voice, both books narrated by their main characters, which I think is a really hard thing to get right. But I think Christopher Bullman does just such wonderful things with kind of like building up to a fight, and then he'll like skip over it as if the person telling you the story didn't want to talk about it and then come back to it later. Or he really makes the most of those kind of like voices in the book. So yeah, both of those books are really good, really fun time. Black Tongue Thief will definitely make you laugh.
I read Black Tongue Thief. I have not read Daughter's War, but I really enjoyed it as well. So I will underscore that. The titular thief is part of a guild where one of the precepts is someone can slap you in the face if they want to, and yeah, they have to let you, you know. Very funny stuff. Christian Spicer, what is your parting gift?
Mine is an album that technically doesn't come out until the 14th, but most of the songs are available already either on Apple Music or Spotify or wherever you get your music. It's called Apologies to the Chef by Wynonna Fighter. My goodness. It is a punk, pop punk album. This is the band's debut album. They are also either already on or just starting a tour to support this album. What a confident debut album. Holy crap. Haven't stopped listening to it. It's so good. I'm so excited for the full release here next Friday. It just rips start to stop. They play with style a little bit within it. But just, it goes hard, it goes fast, it never overstays its welcome. It's one of the most confident debut albums in this genre I've heard in a very long time. It's My Apologies to the Chef by Wynonna Fighter. And yeah, highly, highly, highly recommend it. It's awesome.
Cool stuff. My parting gift is, I'm a big Saturday Night Live fan, have been since I was a little kid. Love Saturday Night Live. You know, whatever you may say about, you know, cast this or who's good or who's not good, it's an institution. And it's a really interesting thing because this year's the 50th anniversary of Saturday Night Live. And Peacock, the streaming service, has a number of really interesting documentaries. There's a multiple episode docuseries called SNL 50 Beyond Saturday Night. that I just kind of put on a whim the other evening. And wow, is this well made. Talk about a view behind the curtain. Incredible stuff. And each episode is completely different from the last. The first episode is basically taking a bunch of the amazing people that you know from Saturday Night Live and showing them their original audition tapes that they've never seen before, and their embarrassment, or they're talking about their time and like what went into their auditioning for Saturday Night Live. Amazing to see that kind of raw, honest look. The second episode is an hour-long documentary about one sketch, the More Cowbell sketch, and how it came to be and all the things that went into it. And it's like Zapruder film level of dissection of one single sketch. Hilarious. The third episode is all about the writers and the life of a writer in Saturday Night Live. It's really great. And there's well-made documentaries, but such juicy information that I don't think anybody has ever revealed before of just sort of how the sausage is made. And if you're a fan of Saturday Night Live like I am, cannot recommend it higher. Really, really interesting, insightful, and inspiring because it's really smart, talented people at this place that is a destination for smart, talented people. All right, we got a listener-suggested parting gift as well. This comes to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com from Richard in Texas. Richard writes, after hearing about y'all's couch co-op experiences with your kids, I wanted to suggest my parting gift, a parting gift I first heard about from Jeff way back, Little Big Planet. I don't know if y'all's PS3s are still hooked up, but I found these games to be a great series for co-op with kids of all ages. It's creative and challenging and forgiving and full of all the same kind of wonder you've all described in the latest Super Mario Brothers game. I think these games are timeless and worth a revisit with your kiddos. Yeah, man, Little Big Planet. That's a good reminder of how delightful those games were and still are. And it's really fun hooking up old systems for your kids. So this is a great recommendation. Thank you, Richard. If you'd like to have your parting gift read on our show, send it to us, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. We appreciate all those. All right. That's going to do it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Gareth Damian Martin and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for those fun bumpers. Our theme song was composed by White Cube, which is Jason Sherry and T. Ryan Arnold. You can always get merchandise for our show by visiting our store. Store.dlcpod.com is where you go for that. Of course, our biggest thanks are always reserved for our patrons at patreon.com/dlcpod. Thank you, patrons, for making the show possible. We'll see you next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.